Hi, I'm Adrian, and today I'll be presenting an evaluation of the Google Chrome extension security architecture. So browser extensions add features to the browser or alter websites. They can do things like read browsing history, read and change websites like your bank. Now here's an example of a Google Chrome extension. It's called Google Voice. So it adds a button to the browser right next to the URL bar. If you click on that, it brings up an extension web page that shows your Google Voice messages. Also, it transforms websites so that anything that looks like a phone number is turned into a link. So if you click on it, it brings up this button that lets you initiate a Google Voice phone call to that number. Unfortunately, many extensions are not written by very security-conscious developers, so they can have vulnerabilities. Now, developers of extensions need to be concerned about two types of attackers. The first is the web attacker. So as I mentioned, extensions interact with websites. Now, if it interacts with a malicious website, that website may try to abuse the point of interaction between itself and the extension in order to, say, gain access to other websites, like maybe your bank, or to gain access to browser APIs, which includes things like browsing history, bookmarks, your location, etc. There's also the threat of a network attacker. Now, a network attacker, by which I mean an active network attacker who's somewhere on the network, who can eavesdrop on HTTP traffic and potentially alter it. So in this case, any XML HTTP requests, which are requests for data from servers, or any HTTP scripts, or any other data that's being pulled down over HTTP, is potentially untrusted and malicious. A network attacker might try to manipulate the extension in order to get access to HTTPS websites, which normally a network attacker would not be able to read or modify, or to get access to information that's stored in one of the browser managers that's accessible through the browser extension API. Now, additionally, note that it can also modify otherwise benign websites if they're delivered over HTTP. So in order to try to help developers protect against these threats, Google Chrome has three particular security mechanisms that are intended to prevent or mitigate extensions bugs. The first one is privilege separation. So the idea here is that instead of just having one extension where all parts of the extension can talk to each other and access the browser API, extensions are split into multiple components. One type of component is known as a content script. Content scripts don't have any privileges. They can't make requests to the browser API. However, they can interact with client-side websites. On the other hand, the core extension can't directly interact with client-side websites, but it can access the browser API. So the idea here is that if there is a malicious website and it manages to compromise a content script, it will have to do one extra step, which is to also compromise the core extension through this data passing channel between the two parts in order to get access to any privileges. Next, there's isolated worlds. Isolated worlds is meant to protect content scripts from malicious websites. So the idea here is that the content script can still access the content, the DOM of the website, but their heaps are completely separated. So that, you know, for example, the website can't look at any of the content script's objects. And last, it has permissions. So the core extension has access to the browser API, but the developer has to specify which parts of the browser API that the extension needs. An attacker can't later add more permissions. The extension is permanently limited to what the developer requests up front. So for example, you know, maybe this one asks for history but not bookmarks. Additionally, permissions control what servers the core extension can contact with XML HTTP requests, and it also limits what websites that content scripts can run on. So in this talk, I'm going to be discussing whether those three mechanisms actually help prevent vulnerabilities. I'm going to do this by talking about a set of vulnerabilities that we found in real-world extensions. Our goal is to take the set of extensions and then try to understand what they say about the effectiveness of these three mechanisms. First, I'm going to talk about whether isolated worlds prevents content script vulnerabilities. Then I'm going to talk about whether privilege separation actually helps protect the core extension. Then I'm going to talk about whether permissions, in practice, mitigate vulnerabilities. And last, since, as I mentioned, we did actually find some vulnerabilities despite these three mechanisms, I'm going to talk about some new defenses to try to defend against the types of vulnerabilities that we found. So I'm going to begin by talking about the set of vulnerabilities that we found in a set of 100 Chrome extensions. We looked at the 50 most popular extensions, as well as 50 randomly selected extensions. So the 50 random extensions range from having, you know, some 100 users to one user, so they're very unpopular. Whereas the 50 most popular had, I think the most popular one had a little over a million users. So our methodology for finding these vulnerabilities was a mix of black box testing and source code analysis. Now, in order to make sure that all the bugs we found are actual vulnerabilities, we built exploits to confirm them. By the way, we notified all the developers that we were able to contact, which was about 80%. The remainder did not have any contact information posted anywhere. So we looked for three main types of vulnerabilities. We looked for vulnerabilities in the core, we looked for vulnerabilities in content scripts, and we also looked for vulnerabilities that extensions may have added to websites. So an extension can add a vulnerability to a website by modifying the website in such a way that it's no longer secure. So for example, an extension might add an HTTP script to an HTTPS website, or it might take data from one website and put it in another. We found 70 of these different types of vulnerabilities in 40 extensions. So 40% of the extensions we looked at had at least one vulnerability. Now, one thing that's worth pointing out is that we found a lot more vulnerabilities that could be leveraged by a network attacker than vulnerabilities that could be leveraged by a web attacker. So I mentioned earlier that our sample set comprised of both popular extensions, that some of which are very popular, and random extensions, some of which did not look very professional. Interestingly enough, though, the 40 vulnerable extensions were divided fairly evenly in this set. And the conclusion I draw here is that popularity didn't really matter. I think the reason for this is because the popular ones were a lot more complex, which translated to larger attack surfaces. They talked to more servers, they talked to more websites, so there are more chances for the developers to make errors. So here's an example of one of the vulnerabilities we found. It's in the extension named SpeedDial, and I believe it's in Pash. So the purpose of this is that you can, you know, bookmark websites you like, and it puts screenshots up there. And it also puts the list of recently closed ones on the bottom. Now, the way it does this is by taking the title of the web page and putting it directly into the HTML on this page. So you can see instances of that up there, down there, and down there. Now, unfortunately, what this means is that an attacker could put some JavaScript in its title, and that would be put right in this page and it would be able to execute. And it would execute with all of the core extension's permissions because this page is part of the core extension. So now I'm going to talk about what these vulnerabilities say about the effectiveness of isolated worlds. So the goal of isolated worlds is to protect content scripts from web attackers. Does it do this? So we only were able to find three content script vulnerabilities. So it looks like it actually did a pretty good job. Now, the main reason why it works so well is there are three main types of errors that developers make. I'm going to talk about all three and how isolated worlds mitigates them. The first type of error is a data as HTML error. The way this mistake works is the developer takes untrusted data and inserts it into HTML as HTML. So if there's a piece of inline JavaScript in this HTML, it'll be able to execute. Now, in isolated worlds, when this happens, the developer will be taking this data and inserting it into the website's HTML. So if there is malicious data in there, it'll execute in the website's isolated world instead of in the content script's isolated world. So what this means is that the developer might have introduced a website vulnerability, or maybe it's just let the website attack itself. But either way, a data's HTML error can't lead to a content script compromise. So the extension itself remains secure. We did find that there were 6 extensions with data as HTML bugs that don't cause content script vulnerabilities. Instead, they caused website vulnerabilities, which is a significant improvement. Additionally, 40% of core extension vulnerabilities were caused by the same type of mistake. But again, in this case, developers can make them, but they don't really cause any harm. The next type of developer error is using eval, or an equivalent construct, to execute untrusted data by taking a string, you pass it to eval, and out comes code. Unfortunately, isolated worlds does not mitigate this bug. Luckily, however, not many content scripts use eval. There were only 2 vulnerabilities due to this mistake, because not many extensions were using eval to begin with. Only 14 extensions used eval at all in their content scripts, and most of them were actually using libraries that use eval, and those libraries were big popular libraries that were performing sanitization, so it didn't lead to any vulnerabilities. And the last type of attack I'm going to talk about is click injection. So the way this works is the developer adds, say, a button or some other UI element to the website. And then when the user supposedly clicks on it, it then performs some privileged action. However, the extension has no way of knowing whether the user is actually the one who clicked on that button. The website itself could fire the event handler. Again, isolated worlds does not mitigate this bug. However, not many extensions make this mistake. We found 1 vulnerability due to this mistake, and that vulnerability doesn't actually yield access to anything. It just tricks the extension into, well, actually, it's Google Voice. It tricks Google Voice into placing a phone call, which is a problem for Google Voice, but it doesn't yield any of the browser-provided extension privileges. So in conclusion, isolated worlds is highly effective because it mitigates common bugs. So even though in 2 of the 3 attack types it doesn't mitigate them, they're really uncommon. So it does target the common course of attack. Next, I'm going to talk about privilege separation. As I mentioned earlier, the goal of privilege separation is to protect core extensions from attack. This is very important because the core extension is the one that has access to permissions. So if you recall earlier, the idea is that the attacker is going to be coming from the client-side website. That website will in some way compromise the content script. Then the content script will try to influence the core extension in some way, say by passing it maliciously crafted data, in order to leverage the core extension's access to the browser API. So a question that arises here is whether regular developers can actually use privilege separation. So we've seen that security experts know how to separate their code into multiple components. The question here is whether regular developers are capable of doing this, or do they have lots of bugs where the content script can send a string to the core extension that the core extension just executes, which defeats the whole purpose of privilege separation. So in order to answer that question, we weren't able to look at content's actual vulnerabilities because there are so few content script vulnerabilities due to the fact that isolated worlds works pretty well. So instead what we did was looked at all of the extensions that have content scripts. Now, if you pretend that their content scripts are vulnerable, what kind of privileges could an attacker get by exercising that boundary between the content script and the core extension? Well, we found that in 7% of the cases, the attacker would be able to get all of the extension's privileges. An example of this is in AdBlock, which also has been patched. So AdBlock allowed its content script to execute predefined functions in the core by sending a message from the content script to the core extension. However, the way they did this was by having a string index the window object. Unfortunately, this also permits arbitrary code execution. So in essence, someone who compromises the content script can also have complete control over the core extension. So that was an example of giving all the extension's permissions away. We also found several cases of extensions granting partial access to some of the permissions. So they didn't allow full privilege full privilege escalation, but they were able to access some of the parts of the core extension. So forcing developers to privilege separate their software, as this finds, will improve security in most cases, but a significant fraction of developers will negate its benefits by accidentally or intentionally, in some cases, circumventing that privilege separation boundary. This is evidenced by the fact that, as I just showed, privilege separation would fully protect most core extensions, but a third of developers did make some effort to circumvent it. Again, either intentionally or accidentally. However, I was just saying that it works kind of well in most cases, but we did find 50 core extension vulnerabilities. This happens because there are some unanticipated types of attacks. So if you remember, I was saying earlier, what was supposed to happen is that the client-side website compromises the content script, which then compromises the core extension. But there are some attacks that let you work around that. For example, there's a website metadata attack. In this type of vulnerability, or in this type of attack, the client-side website can influence what ends up in one of the browser manager's data stores. So for example, history. By, say, changing the title of the page. The title gets saved in an unsanitized format in the history data store. Then, when the core extension asks for the history of a page from the browser API, browser API will return that untrusted title. Now, the problem here is that, in many cases, developers trusted what they were being given because it was coming from the browser API, I guess without thinking about the fact that it originated from a website. So we did find 5 vulnerabilities that would be susceptible to this type of attack. Now, perhaps more seriously are the vulnerabilities we found that don't come from a web attacker at all, but instead come from the network attacker. So you'll notice that this architecture doesn't separate the network attacker from privileges at all. So sometimes developers do things like they put HTTP scripts in the core extension, or they request HTTP data. Both of which, if there is a network attacker present, are sources of malicious code or data. And indeed, we found that 16 extensions requested data from HTTP sources, and 28 extensions load HTTP scripts. So this is a bit of a problem. So we found that privilege separation can be powerful in the majority of cases in the intended design model where the attack was coming from a website, it would have helped. However, its placement in the system is what really determines whether or not it ends up being an effective security mechanism. So something else is needed to protect core extensions because privilege separation isn't doing it. At the end of the talk, I'm going to talk about some potential defenses that hopefully will do this. Next, I'm going to talk about permissions. So the goal of permissions is to limit the scope of core vulnerabilities by saying that if, let's imagine an extension is completely compromised, it's still limited to the initial set of permissions that the developer requested, which hopefully will be less than the set of full permissions. So let's take a look at whether or not permissions actually helped. So there are 27 extensions with core vulnerabilities. Of them, 44% have the most high severity permissions. The remainder have medium, low, or none. So what this means is that the potential for high severity attacks occurring has now been reduced by a little bit more than half, because only, actually less than half of the vulnerable extensions have access to high severity permissions. Now, one thing that I was thinking is that if you've got developers that are making these bad security mistakes, are they also going to make mistakes when requesting permissions? We have seen in past work that authors of extensions do sometimes ask for more permissions than they need. So what I've got here is a comparison between the permission request rate of buggy extensions to the permission request rate of the rest of extensions. Now, what you should be noticing here is that there's not really a difference. In fact, the extension that didn't have core extension vulnerabilities actually requests permissions at a slightly higher rate, although the difference is not statistically significant. So what this means is that there's no correlation between bugs and permissions. So if you look at the system's overall permission request rate, and I suspect that this might even hold for other platforms, that gives you a good estimate of what types of permissions that extensions that are vulnerable will have. So in conclusion, yes, we find that permissions do limit the scope of vulnerabilities in practice. Now, I mentioned earlier that despite these defenses, we found a whole bunch of core extension vulnerabilities. And so we proposed and evaluate some potential defenses. Now, the root cause of these vulnerabilities is that developers are using unsafe coding practices in order to write their extensions. Now, around the time that we were doing this work, Chrome had introduced content security policy for extensions so that at the time developers could voluntarily choose to restrict what types of language features their extensions could use. Now, our proposal was to use the same mechanism to just outright ban certain unsafe coding practices. So we proposed a few bans. I'm going to talk about some of them here. For each of them, we looked at what percentage of the 100 extensions would have a vulnerability fixed by the ban, what percentage would be broken by the ban, but in a way that would be easily fixable, and also what percentage of extensions would be broken, just irrevocably broken. You wouldn't be able to fix them. So the first thing we looked at was not allowing core extensions to include HTTP scripts at all. They would have to switch all their HTTP scripts to HTTPS scripts. So this would fix vulnerabilities in 15% of the extensions. That same exact set of 15% of extensions would also be broken for it, since their HTTP scripts would no longer work. However, in all of those cases that would be fixable, all the scripts are also offered over HTTPS. So we do recommend the adoption of this. The next is banning inline scripts. So if you recall, in the data as HTML attack, the way it works is you have untrusted data that contains some JavaScript in it that the developer has accidentally stuck somewhere in HTML. So that's an inline script. So the idea here is to just ban all inline scripts so that you can't mix JavaScript and HTML in the body of the core extension pages. So this would also fix vulnerabilities in 15% of the extensions. It would break 79% of extensions because developers do often use inline scripts. However, most of those could be fixed with about 5 to 10 minutes of copying and pasting. So it's in most extensions, it's not really a huge burden to remove inline scripts. And it doesn't irrevocably break any of them. So again, we recommend this one. There's also the possibility of banning eval, since some developers were making mistakes by putting untrusted data from the network into eval. So banning eval would fix vulnerabilities in 3% of extensions. It would break 30%, but most of those are fixable because developers are using them to do things that you can do without eval. However, 2% of extensions would be completely broken because they require eval to work. So since it's fixing 3%, but completely breaking 2%, we recommend against this one a little bit, but it's sort of an even game. And last, the idea is to ban HTTP, XML, HTTP requests from core extensions. So core extensions wouldn't be allowed to request data over HTTP, only over HTTPS. This would fix 17% of extensions vulnerabilities. But if you notice, it would permanently break 14%. And that's because a lot of these sites, a lot of the extensions are associated with little sites that don't have HTTPS. And it's, you know, some people can't afford to or don't know how to set up HTTPS. So that would impose a fairly big burden on developers. Luckily, though, most of those 17% vulnerabilities that are fixed by this ban are also fixed by banning inline scripts. So again, we recommend against that one. Now, we worked with the Google Chrome extension team on this, and they did decide to go ahead and adopt some of these bans. So the ones that are now shown in green ended up being adopted by them. To handle the extension breakage problem, what they decided to do was create a new type of sandbox that extension developers can run eval in, but doesn't have access to any of the extensions privileges or permissions. So overall, the policy that they ended up adopting, which was those three, fixes vulnerabilities in 27% of extensions, which is virtually all of the core extension vulnerabilities. Requires 85% of extensions be changed in some manner, but not a major manner, and potentially breaks 2% depending on whether you could the people who are using eval could get their extension to work without it. So in conclusion, we found that Isolated Worlds does succeed at preventing content scripts from websites by preventing common bugs. Because of that, privilege separation isn't actually needed very often in this system. However, we looked at the cases, at how it is used in other cases, and found that some developers don't use privilege separation optimally, the same way that some developers request extra permissions. So possibly tools to help developers better privilege separate their applications would be helpful. Permissions do, in fact, reduce the scope of vulnerabilities in practice. You don't see something crazy like all the vulnerable ones asking for all permissions. And we recommended a set of bans on unsafe coding practices in order to protect the core extension better. And indeed, the Chrome extension team did end up adopting some of these. I believe the current status is that all new extensions have to comply with the ban. And in the future, in a few months, as extensions are updated, they will have to comply with the bans as well. Are there any questions?
Let's thank the speaker. Please use the microphone and please state your name and affiliation.
Thank you. My name is Lior and I'm from Intel. Very good talk. Interesting too. My question is about the relationship between the extension to the browser, because my thought is that if a malicious extension can compromise the browser, then all the security mechanisms that the browser provides are gone, right? So then any extension can do whatever it wants. So if you can comment in technical terms about address separation in the browser address space and how apps are loaded into that address space, or what's the mechanism that the browser uses to separate itself from these extensions?
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, I actually can't answer it. We focus mostly on assuming these mechanisms work as intended. What would the outcome be?
Okay.
I'm actually not aware of any extensions that have managed to compromise that boundary, though.
Okay, thank you.
So to sort of answer your question, Adam Langley, Google. The content scripts, I believe, run in the render process, and the render process is sandbox with Chrome's normal sandbox, and any background pages in the extension also run in their own processes. So you could imagine a bad extension compromising Chrome, but it would have to go through the normal Chrome sandbox, which is a reasonably high bar. If you've seen any of the blog posts we did recently of the pwn2own vulnerabilities, it's quite a long and impressive chain of vulnerabilities that we require to break through that.
I see. So
Can we take this offline?
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
Keep comments to the presentation. Okay, I actually have a question. So at the very beginning of your paper, you said most of the vulnerabilities you found couldn't be found with static analysis, but it did seem like some fraction were found rather simple utilities like grep. Could you comment a little bit on, is this a problem with static analysis tools being stupid or a fundamental limit?
I definitely don't think it's a fundamental limit. In fact, I think most of them could be found if there was a static analysis tool that understood how the browser API works and how the DOM works and also the channel between the components. We did try to adapt a well-known commercial static analysis tool to serve this purpose, but their string tracking wasn't good enough. We tested it on 6 of the extensions that we thought had vulnerabilities, and if I recall, I don't think it found any of them. So we didn't pursue that. If there were another static analysis tool that were available to us that were better, perhaps it would be more useful. But you would have to model the browser API, DOM, etc., if the tool doesn't already do it.
That's all the time we have for questions. Let's thank our speaker again.